And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time. Time for an extra special exclusive Media Masters interview with me. You know, voiceover man, off of the telly, X Factor, Britain's Got Talent, live at the Apollo and all that guff. Please welcome Paul Blanchard in conversation with me, Peter Dixon.
Well, as you've just heard, welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the voiceover artist and announcer Peter Dixon. Peter was recently voted one of the most iconic voices of the decade and is known for the voice behind Britain's Got Talent, The X Factor, Family Fortunes, Comic Relief and countless other TV shows, films, sporting events and games. Peter, I don't think my intro's doing yours any justice so far, but anyway. You got your start in front of the camera, it says here, presenting the news for the BBC at just 17. Wow, we'll ask you about that later. And you remain, so far, their youngest ever TV news presenter. You later moved on to radio, presenting your own entertainment show, Peter Dixon's Nightcap for Radio 2, and launched Melody Radio in London with Lord Hanson. So, Peter, thank you ever so much for joining me.
Very nice to be here, Paul, and what an introduction.
By us both. To be honest, we've never kind of double-teamed this before, no, so that was quite interesting.
Yeah, it's a new territory for both of us, yeah.
So this is a really open question then, but how do you end up from being kind of the BBC's youngest news TV presenter to the voice of The X Factor, Britain's Got Talent, and this iconic voice that everyone in the country knows and loves so much?
Well, I often ask myself that question. I'm not quite sure of the answer. None of it was planned, that's for sure. The early desire to be on the radio, I can trace back to the days when my father had a very old valve radio. You know, one of those lovely old wood veneer radios that had traditional old-fashioned orange glowing valves inside them. And I remember as a 4 or 5 year old, maybe I was a bit older, I can't quite recall, but I remember looking at this radio and thinking, how wonderful is this? I could hear these wonderful fruity voices coming out of the radio set from the Light Programme and the BBC World Service,
wow,
the Home Service. And I just thought this was the most marvellous thing as a young boy. It's a bit weird, I know, but it did actually captivate me. And I think if you speak to most people in radio, they have this kind of these moments in their lives where they get that that inspiration, that flash, that spark that really sends them on their journey. I think that was where mine came from. And so I just had this fascination with radio, and I listened to it a lot. And then as I grew older and through got to be doing my O-levels and A-levels at school, I decided that that was a career I wanted to pursue. And so while I was still at school, I rather cheekily, as a 17-year-olds tend to be, applied to the BBC to read the news and do continuity announcing.
So you always wanted to be airside? You never wanted to be kind of behind the glass, the producer, the editor, whatever?
No, I didn't really know what I wanted. I knew I just wanted to work for the BBC. I grew up in Northern Ireland. I went to school in Belfast, and this was the height of the Troubles. It was a difficult period, and the BBC itself was under attack. And I remember thinking that this is an important organisation, and I really want to be a part of it. And indeed, at 17, I applied to go in and have an interview with a very odd man who was the head of the presentation department in Belfast, and he gave me an interview, like an interview I'd never had before. And I kind of dodged around the issue of my age. He asked me how old I was. I said, I'm a student, and was rather vague about it. And these were the days, you have to remember, before human resources departments were even thought of.
Well, now you wouldn't even get an interview.
You wouldn't get an interview, no. It's different times, very different times now. To be honest, they weren't averse to a bit of child labour and exploitation in those days, all over, not
it's
just the
cheap,
BBC, but everywhere.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic opportunity. And that was on a Wednesday afternoon. I think they called me back and said, can you start on Monday?
Wow.
Reading the late night closed down. These were the days when radio closed down at night and there was no sustaining service through the night. And so
which is, of course, now called Five Live.
Yes. So I got called in, and with a minimal amount of training, I have to say, I was invited to read the closing news before and close the station down at
and
night.
And this was for BBC Northern Ireland.
Yes, this was in radio. It was BBC Northern Ireland Radio Ulster, as it was and still is, the regional radio service for that part of the world. And so I did that, and it was the most amazing. I couldn't believe my luck. I couldn't believe that this was actually happening. And while I was just in the transition between school and university, this started in the summer term before I went to university. And then when I started my degree course, I carried on working for the BBC in various roles and eventually ended up presenting television news as well, reading TV
news. Age 17?
Well, I would have been, 18, 19 by then.
Again, it's still incredibly impressive.
Again, it's kind of not prime time, but it was sort of the end of the day or the beginning of the day stuff. And I then got the idea that maybe journalism was an interesting career. And as I alluded to earlier, Belfast, this would be in the late 70s. It was a really strife-torn city, and there was a lot of daily atrocities being carried out in the name of one side or the other. And so with that amount of media attention on Belfast, a lot of the network journalists and people who have since gone on to make big names for themselves came through the Belfast newsroom. So I counted among my colleagues back in the day, Jeremy Paxman and Kate Adey and Nicholas Witchell, people of that sort of calibre, James Robbins, and many, many more. And I got this sort of thought in my head that, maybe news reading's fine, but I thought maybe journalism might be radio journalism or TV journalism, whatever you want to call it, would be the way to go. And so I embarked on a little bit of radio journalism training, then was let loose on the breakfast show, the Good Morning Ulster, which is their current affairs today, the equivalent of the Radio 4's Today show, as a reporter. And after about 3 months or so, I suddenly realised, I'm absolutely dreadful. I couldn't sniff out a story to save my life.
After 3 months, that's quite impressive, actually, to realise.
It was a fairly gradual process, I have to say. It was 3 or 4 months, and I thought, no, this is really not for me. And, thank goodness I made the decision to pull the plug on it, because I remember just too many awkward interviews where I got facts and figures wrong, and it wasn't a career that I should be following. And
my technique is to just ask open questions with no facts or figures whatsoever.
That's true too. I mean, that can carry you quite far as well.
I've not been found out yet, and we've been doing this podcast 2 years. So anyway, please carry
on. This may be the day.
Yeah, it might will be. It will come one day, I can assure you.
I was just then thinking, what am I going to do with myself? What can I do useful that I would be interested in doing? I thought I'd go back to announcing presentation work. And I answered this advert in Ariel, which was the BBC's in-house newspaper. There was a thing called the attachment system, where within the BBC you could move to a different department for a 6 month period and see whether you liked it. And if you were good at it, they would perhaps extend that into a more lengthy contract. And so I saw this advert for BBC Radio 2 announcer, and it was a 6 months attachment, and I applied for it. Even though I was living in Northern Ireland at the time, it would have involved a move to London with all that upheaval. But, when you're that age, it's fine. You can deal with that. So I applied for the job, was called for an interview, and was, to my amazement, utter amazement, offered the 6 months contract to be an announcer on the Radio 2 network.
Wow, which presumably even then was a prestigious, very well-listened-to network and an amazing promotion.
Huge, And so, I found myself reading the news on Terry Wogan's show and introducing huge stars like Morecambe and Wise down at the old Paris studio in Lower Regent Street, which sadly no longer there. I think it's a pizza shop.
It is.
It was, it was a wonderful time. That was a wonderful era. Now, that would have been around about the 80s, from 81 to 89, and a very fertile period. And at the end of that period, sort of, John Burt became the director general of the BBC, and there was a huge sea change in the way that organisation was structured and operated. And it became
bringing a lot of kind of market reforms, producer choice, all of this kind of
exactly.
Stuff.
And we got to the situation where I remember talking to a Radio 1 producer at one point, and he said, it's actually cheaper for me to go down, to leave the office and go down to Oxford Street, to HMV, and buy a record with departmental cash rather than borrowing it from the BBC's own library, which is, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out there's something wrong. I was there for a glorious 9 years, I think it was. It was just the most wonderful time, working with some fantastic colleagues and doing some really interesting work, most of it live on national radio. And I had an absolute blast. I loved every second of it and wouldn't swap it for the world. And it was just wonderful. But I remember every year we had an annual interview, and the Radio 2 controller at the time was a guy called Bryant Marriott, who was a wonderful man. I think he was ex-Navy, but he had this rather grand office in Broadcasting House, and you'd go up every year to have your annual interview with him. Your line manager, my line manager, would have written me up, and then there'd be a report produced, and he'd sit there. And you'd literally walk in, and he'd be puffing on his pipe, and he'd take a seat, scotch. And, you know, you'd be offered a scotch out of this.
Why not?
Lovely cut glass tumbler. And, you know, it was all very gentlemanly and rather sort of you know, rather quaint in a way. And as I think those days have largely gone, and the BBC is now a very much different place. But I think I was there right at the end of a very golden period and lucky to have seen it.
Was there anyone that was on air then that's still on air now? I mean, obviously, Woven's just recently departed, but I imagine Steve Wright was still on Radio 1 at that point, wasn't he?
Well, Steve Wright was on Radio 1.
Jimmy Young, was he doing that?
Jimmy Young was around, yes, and Kenny Everett I worked with as well.
Kenny,
you know, there was some really great characters around in those days. But I remember Steve Wright as a case in point, because we used to all go to the same canteen on the 7th floor of Broadcasting House, and lunchtime, I remember finding myself in the queue with Steve Wright, and we just struck up a conversation and started just mucking about and doing voices, and his producer was with him at the time, and we sat down, had lunch, and for one reason or another, I just sort of came out with it. I blurted it out, and I said, let's do some telephone characters for your show. Let me try and develop some characters we could run on your show. I could do it over the phone, so, you know, I don't have to turn up. If I'm not at work, we can do it down the phone from home. So we developed some characters. I came up with this character called Mr. Mad, who was...
I remember Mr. Mad from when I was a kid.
Mr. Mad, he was just a lunatic, basically. He just came out with random, surreal nonsense. And I remember doing this live on Steve's show in the afternoon, when he was on the afternoons at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I remember, on one particular day, reading the news on Radio 2, the 3 o'clock news.
In the serious voice.
In the serious voice, closing the microphone, and then calling Continuity K, wherever it was, in Egton House, and speaking to Steve. And within 5 minutes, I was on Radio 1 as Mr. Mad.
And did anyone know your dark secret?
Nobody knew the dark secret. I kept it very quiet.
So did you always, was that something that naturally emerged, or did you kind of discover in yourself a propensity for merriment and comedy?
Well, the greatest fear, of course, was that I get the voices round the wrong way and read the news as Mr. Mad. But I'd always had a penchant or a talent for doing voices and mimicry and impressions and character voices. And so this gave me an outlet to do that. And over the period of the remainder of his time on the Radio 1 afternoon show, Steve Wright in the afternoon, his posse, his voices, I created, you know, several other characters. And then when he went on to Breakfast Show, I created this character called Voiceover Man, who was largely based on a larger-than-life version of me. So it was an interesting one to do. And Voiceover Man was very popular with the audience. And
still is.
And still is. And I remember, because he was on Breakfast, I had to do that from home, from my bed, actually. I used to write the scripts the night before. I always wanted two pieces, one for, you know, 8 o'clock.
So you had to write all your own material as well?
I wrote my own material, yeah. And that was a bit of a pressure. At the end of the day, when you've had a long day, you think, oh, goodness me, I've got to go and be funny now and write a script which I can read the next morning. And so I'd have these two scripts. And I remember he'd ring me up and sometimes wake me up, and I'd have the scripts by the bedside. And he'd say, what have you got? And he'd get me to read the script through, and he'd approve it or edit it.
So was he producing his own show then?
He produced a lot of his show.
Yeah,
he had a producer, but he is probably one of the best radio producers.
People don't really know that about Steve, he's the main producer of his own show.
An absolute perfectionist in many respects, and very controlling. He wanted to control every aspect of the show, so quite rightly so. He's got his name on it, and he was very good at that. And so he'd asked me to read this script off air before we went on air. Having read the script to him, I then I used to tease him quite a bit. I would then, when we went live, I would just literally swap the scripts over and start reading the script that he hadn't heard first. And you could hear the tension in his voice rising, because, you know, he was terrified that whatever I was going to say might libel somebody or slander somebody, which, of course, I never did. But you know, as a measure of the man, that he never got, you know, sued for it. He was very, he was terrified of, because of the live nature of that show.
So you went from controlled fun to actual fun, and that was a bit of a loss of control on Steve's part.
Yeah, and I enjoyed that, and I think it also kept him on his toes. And you could hear, you know, the unpredictability of the situation, and sometimes we'd just start laughing uncontrollably. And he'd have to go
to a record.
Which
is always funny.
Yeah, I mean, it is funny when that happens, and I think the audience love it too.
Absolutely. You know? And did you feel then that this was your career now settling down, that you'd found a kind of niche for yourself as a kind of comedy voiceover performer?
I think that was the sort of genesis of it. Yes, I certainly realised that after, you know, I'd done this for a period of time, that this was something that you could actually maybe do for a living. But the transition from Radio 2 to freelance was a tricky decision to take, not least because, you know, when you do go freelance from the comfort of a salaried position, you have to kind of hit the deck running. Radio 2 were very good to me. They offered me, I think it was 2 or 3 days a week instead of a full-time job. It sort of went down to part-time. I'm so pleased I did because, you know, I'd probably still be there, maybe, you know, although the announcing department at Radio 2 is all but decimated now. I think that Dedicote was the last man standing there, you know, so, but I think...
Alan's voice is amazing, of course, as well. Great voice.
Yeah, but there was a regular roster. There was, you know, 15 or 20 announcers there on regular work. And
a decimal point now. I think there's 1.5 or 2.0
probably, yeah. But those were the days when, you know, it was all analogue. It was tape and there was no digits. You couldn't store, you know, it wasn't so easy to create banks of script and intros for shows that are all done digitally and run computerized through computers now.
So was there a kind of entrepreneurial initiative there? You thought, right, I'm going to go freelance, I'm going to achieve X, Y, and Z. What was on your mind at the time? What was the motivation?
I think it was just that I was getting to the point after 9 years of doing that job that I wasn't learning anymore. I was just feeling a little bit stale and repeating myself. And I thought, you know, I'd done so many elements to that job. There was live continuity announcing, running the network, news reading, creating promos and trailers, doing live introductions for shows in theatres, writing your own scripts. And those are great disciplines for anyone considering a freelance career post the BBC. So I got to the point after 9 years that I thought, actually, I'm not learning anymore and I'm getting a little bit bored. So I took the decision to go freelance. And as soon as I made that decision, it's interesting, isn't it, how when you put the word out there, things do come to you. And I had a phone call from a company who were starting up a radio station in London called Melody Radio. It was Lord Hanson's new baby on the Brompton Road, and they were looking for presenters for that station. And I was considered for one of these presenter roles and got the job as initially mid-morning presenter and then moving to breakfast. It wasn't the happiest of experiences, I have to say. It was... a precursor to Smooth, I think it is, or was it Magic?
Mm. It's Magic now.
Magic, yeah. But what I hadn't realised when I took the job is that they really, that one of the strap line for the radio station was more music, less talk. And so I then found myself reading liner cards and reading the news, and that was about it.
So no spontaneity, originality, creativity. Absolutely. There was no chance to kind of inject your personality and your talent into it.
No, there wasn't. It was... a means to an end for me to get out of the BBC and another kind of platform which I could be finished at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, and have that guarantee of an income. And then from there, from 10 o'clock in the morning, I'd go out and do my...
And build on it with kind of extra work.
Yeah, so absolutely. I'd be getting commercial work. I'd be going to radio stations and various studios in London and agencies as a gun for hire, if you like, and just doing the voiceovers in addition to that presenting job.
You must have already had quite a strong reputation even then because of what you'd done kind of with Steve Wright and all these other things.
Yes, I think all these things, if you look back on anyone's career, there are sometimes it's a linear line going from point A to B. Sometimes it's, you know, you have troughs and peaks. But ultimately, all that experience builds on each other. And so you've got this sort of skill set progression. You become more expert and more knowledgeable about the business and about how it all works. And I'm still learning. You know, it's really interesting that even after 41 years of using my voice as my main source of income, that after 41 years of that, I still... The more I know, the less I know almost. The more I realise I don't know. And I'm still fascinated by the minutiae of what I do. Because now, as a freelance voiceover, people ask me what it's like, and I say, well, I think I probably spend 5% of my time doing the actual work, the voiceovers. The rest of it is done, you know, you have to wear so many hats. Marketing, I'm a recording engineer.
Relationship building with all the producers.
Clients, management, accountancy, all the various elements that any business has, you know, as a one-man band, you have to look after. And so those are all skills that require learning and management. And I find it endlessly fascinating, you know, that no 2 days are the same for me.
How does it physically work? I mean, do you work from home? Do you have a studio? And how do you, you know, how do you get jobs like The X Factor and Britain's Got Talent and so on? I mean, do people come to you or is it via an agency? How does it actually work?
I sent Simon Cowell an envelope containing some photographs that I'd taken of him in a hotel bedroom in Barcelona in 1986, I think it was, and asked him if I could have the job.
They were in HD.
Behold,
I hope they were in HD.
Oh, yes, the old negatives. I think I read this wonderful book about, called The Black Swan by Nicholas Taleb, and he talks about, somebody asked him, what's the secret to success or how do you be successful? And he said, just go to more parties and never run for a train. Those were the two pieces of advice. I just made a decision after reading that. I thought, I'll go out and I'll meet more people and get out there because the world doesn't come to you.
And it doesn't, sadly.
And, you know, I made that mistake very early on in my career. I thought, well, I've worked for the BBC. I've done, you know, all these years of, I've got all these years of experience. I've done all this work. I've met all these people. I've got all these contacts. And I went freelance and I sat back and the phone didn't ring as much as I thought it would.
You've got to hustle.
It never does. Even today, you know, I'm always looking for opportunities. I'm always out there meeting people. It's just down to being being nice to people, having contacts with people on a daily basis, and opportunities will present themselves to you. And you create your own luck in so many ways.
And in a sense, are you penalised by the kind of, because you are at the very top of your game and one of the most widely recognised voices in the UK, do people assume that you're completely, you know, minted and very busy and wouldn't want to take anything on? How, in a sense, you have to say, you know, guys, I am still available.
Yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? I think part of the freelance curse, if you like, and one of the things that I've been prone to is that I can very rarely say no to anything. And this is something I really don't want to do. But I always try and bend over backwards to say yes to things because you never really know where that opportunity leads to. A lot of them, you know, just one-off jobs, but sometimes you'll work with somebody that you were slightly apprehensive about working with, and lo and behold, you know, that contact, that job leads to so much more. You know, and there's some very rich veins that I've managed to get to just by saying yes to something that I didn't really know where it would lead. I'm a bit of a yes man, much to my wife's dismay, because you know, she said, "Oh, you do too much.
Work is work."
Yeah, work as a freelancer. You're absolutely right, and you know, you can be a little bit picky and choosy, but at the end of the day, you know, you've got to do the work, and a nice mix of work as well is good. So, you know, a great day for me would be in the morning playing a zombie in a computer game, and then in like after lunch maybe reading the chairman's report for a large blue chip company, and then in the evening maybe working with my American agent recording some commercials for American TV or radio, or doing a promo or a trailer for a film. So there's lots of variety in that, and that's what I like. I really enjoy that gear changing process during the day.
Because someone might naively assume that all you ever do day in day out is just that kind of voiceover kind of man character that you do for The X Factor and Britain's Got Talent and so on. But I would imagine that only represents maybe 5 or 10% of what you do.
Well, you're right in a way, but when The X Factor is actually on air, because it's such a high-profile show and it's listened to by so many people or watched by so many people, rather, it's all people think you do, really. And so by Christmas time, I spent 3 or 4 months in the lead-up to Christmas in padded rooms shouting at the top of my lungs. And, you know, while that's fun, up to a point, by Christmas time, I just want to sit down and read some poetry or something quiet, you know. It can be a bit of a curse. Having said that, I'm ever so grateful to that program and for raising my profile, which it has undoubtedly done, and I still enjoy it. Very happy to continue my association with it for as long as it lasts, and I don't know how long it will last. I mean, 13 years is probably at the outer limits of of that particular format. Maybe they'll do another year or two, I don't know.
Without wanting to kind of sound like a PR guy and a PR cliche, you are synonymous with the brand, really. I don't think the audience would stand for it if you started to step away from, you know, the Michael McIntyre's Roadshow and BGT and all of these kind of things. You're part of the unique mix of ingredients of that programme.
Well, you do, in a sense, become part of the furniture, and that's you know, it's a nice place to be. I think the issue is though that when you are, as you rightly alluded earlier, when you're associated so strongly with something like that and with producing that particular big sound, that's tends to be, you know, your what you get asked to do a lot of, rather like a soap actor or somebody who's been in a process or in a production for a long time. They get associated and tagged and shelved and pigeonholed in that area. And I guess that's just the way the business works. You can't really do anything about that. You either get out or put up, you know. And it's been great for me. And, you know, I still manage to do lots of other things as well. I'm happy to do everything that comes my way within reason. So it's been a great career so far. And, you know, I've loved every second of it.
So, Peter, how does it physically work then in terms of like when you're doing the X Factor? Do you do it from home or are you kind of in a side studio or is it a mix of the two? Do you do a bit from your own studio? Are you always in client studios? How does, or are you like us now where we kind of rent studios by the hour?
I would say in the 80s, certainly, when I did Family Fortunes, and that was all done as live in a studio, and I would be on the studio floor doing my voiceovers in real time as it was going down on the tape. And many shows before that I'd done... had all been in situ, live, as the show was being recorded.
And does that help, or does it hinder?
I don't think it really made any great difference. I think part of what the secret I was going to let you into was that the X Factor, Britain's Got Talent, all those shows, are now a kit of parts. The show is live, for sure, when they go live. All those shows are live and in real time, but a lot of the elements, the video, obviously my voiceovers, are pre-recorded, in my particular case, the day before. So on a Friday evening, afternoon, I will get an email from the producers with the script. And I will sit in my own studio, on my own, recording endless variations of
who might
the same
win,
line.
Who's up, who's down, etc.
Yeah, I mean, we record a kit of parts before the show starts with all the contestants' names. There are only 12, so there's 12 names to read. And I read them all in rising inflections, neutral inflections and falling inflections so that those names can be plucked out of the jigsaw and put into the jigsaw puzzle and adapted accordingly to whatever they want me to say. The point is, with the digital revolution, you know, with digital recording and digital storage of audio, all these things became not only possible but cheaper to do. And so, you know, home studios, the barrier to entry to creating your own home studio, the price of that fell dramatically in the, you know, the early 90s. And, you know, digital equipment became you know, cheaper than the old taped reel-to-reel tapes and analog and all the other equipment and stuff you had to have. Computer power increased. So nowadays, you know, I literally work off a MacBook and a microphone plugged into it. And that's all I have. I've got ISDN lines as well in my studio at home so I can work around the world. But by and large, mostly now, it is digital delivery of files via the internet, MP3 and WAV files.
So and most that, of the time you're working from home?
I'd say about 50% of the time I work from home. The rest of it I'd be in studios in London, mainly working with agencies on various campaigns and projects. But a lot of it I can do either remotely sending files to studios or working on live sessions via ISDN line. That digital revolution, if you like, really revolutionized the way I work, because up to that point, I physically had to be in the studio where the production was being made. So in the case of Family Fortunes, I had to go to Nottingham. In the case of working for Metro Radio Newcastle, I physically had to go to Newcastle. And there were lots of us, I say lots, maybe about 20 or 30 voices in Britain at that time, who were on the circuit, and we used to physically travel from west to east and north to south, up and down the country every day of the week, sometimes staying in the hotels on the way back. The number of miles you put on the car and the amount of time wasted in travelling was horrendous and took its toll on many of us, including me. So when, you know, the internet finally got its act together and, you know, broadband speeds increased, and digital technology, the barriers to entry in terms of price came down and computing power increased, all that together completely revolutionised the way I work. And so I can literally be at home and be working, chasing the sun around the world, you know, work in Australia, in Dubai, in the UK, and then work in America in the evening if you wanted to. I mean, you could literally work 24 hours a day, which, you know, thankfully I don't have to, but you could if you wanted to.
But has the internet been a kind of curse as well as a blessing? Because now anyone, like you said, with a MacBook and a reasonable quality microphone can be one of your competitors. I mean, how competitive is the industry generally? Do you just know whether you've got a job or not? Or do you know that you're in the running against, say, two or three other people? Are they your kind of bitter rivals, or do you all get on and it's a kind of an abundance mentality? How does it work?
Again, it's a hugely different landscape to when I first started out. As I mentioned, there were a handful of people doing it. A lot of actors in the early days, well-known names, didn't do commercials because they thought it was sullying them.
Yeah,
oh, no, dear boy, I couldn't do that.
So, I don't think they'd say that now, would they?
No. Everybody is now doing it, so it seems. There are literally thousands and thousands of people who are competing for work in the voice over business today around the world in all English-speaking territories. Somebody came up with a figure the other day of the number of voice. I can't remember the figure, but it was quite an astonishing figure in the millions. Worldwide.
Wow.
Then you've got to say, well, not all those people are equally skilled. You know, you've got people who call themselves voiceover artists who maybe have been doing it a month. They've got the computer, they've got the software and the microphone and, you know, all the gear and no idea. And there is much more to being a voice artist than just having a good voice. As I mentioned earlier, there are many elements to being successful in my business, the first of which is being able to read other people's copy effectively and to be able to know how to interpret other people's words and make it sound like it's like they are your words rather than somebody else's. That's a skill which takes a long time to actually grow and develop. The other elements to the job we've spoken about, the marketing, PR side, the acquiring and keeping clients, management of clients, finding new opportunities and avenues. All of these things, all of those skill sets are necessary to be successful, and they take time. So when people say to me, oh, you've got a fantastic job, it's easy, you know, anybody can speak, anybody can read, that's true. But combining all of those skills, which take time to acquire, takes a long time to develop. And I think, you know, the illusion is that what I do is easy and it's money for a rope and anyone can do it. Well, let me assure you that anybody can't do it. It takes, you know, quite a bit of effort and skill and time to be able to do it well, to support your family doing that.
But your kind of voiceover man character is so beloved that you've actually been at the cutting edge of monetizing it. I mean, I remember many years ago buying your app on my iPhone, getting you to say random things.
Mm, yeah. Well, that all stemmed from when I started doing corporate events. That's another rich vein that I like because it's you know, usually in the evening and they're fairly social and you get to meet all kinds of wonderful people. And I really do enjoy getting out of the studio and meeting people in different industries to mine. And so I end up, you know, at various conventions and awards events. And when they see me there and people know who I am, invariably they ask me to record their voicemail message for them on their mobile, which I'm delighted to do and happy to do that.
I was hesitant to ask you at the end of this because I was thinking of asking you to do that myself, but I thought, is that cheesy?
No, it's funny. I'll happily do it for whoever asks. But the demand was so great. People were saying, oh, can you do this? And I used to, you know, make a note of their email address and record it in my studio and send it to them. And I eventually came to the conclusion I was doing a lot of this. Why don't I get somebody to build a website that can handle all this for me? And so that's where My Ruddy Voice came from. Sadly, we've now run to the end of that particular site. We've decided to close it down because we're moving on to other things.
Well, these things have a shelf life, don't they? Of course
yeah,
they do.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think, you know, we just took a decision that it was taking up too much of my time to do. So I was recording bespoke messages and you could buy stuff off the shelf from the website. And it was fun while it lasted. And the iPhone app was another genius idea where I recorded virtually every single phrase that you could possibly think of and thousands of different names, Christian names, you know, first names for people, and you could, using the app, construct sentences by cherry-picking from the database the words and phrases that you wanted to combine. But it was, it really took off, and people, I think, I don't know how many downloads we had, but it was, in the multiple thousands.
Do you ever kind of get recognised by your voice? Because you don't sound like the character, as it were, but and obviously it's an audio thing, so do you quite like the fact that you can walk into the local supermarket and not be recognised in the same way? But on the other hand, if you choose to kind of put on the voice, people know who you are straight away.
Cashier number three, please. Imagine if I went into a supermarket and ordered.
That would be brilliant if you did that.
2 pints of beer and a packet of pork scratchings, please. And don't muck about. You know, but it is actually probably one good way of getting a space at the bar. But I think if you did it too much, they'd probably throw you out and bar you. One of the great things about my work is it is largely unseen. So I do have the best of both worlds. You know, I can be working alongside some of the biggest names in the business. And when I walk out onto the street, nobody knows who you are. You can be anonymous and get on with your life and be as normal, at least as normal a life as anybody else, which is exactly the way I want it. And I pop up occasionally on telly and do the odd thing here and there, but fame is not something that I would ever crave. And I've been around some very famous people and I've been friendly with quite a few. And one of the things I've concluded is that there's nothing good ever comes out of being famous. And I've never really understood people who desire fame. You know, it should be an end product, or not a desirable end product either, of what you do for your work. You know, so actors,
but not something in and of itself to go.
No, but
for.
I think this culture we're in now, this celebrity-driven culture, is, and it's quite worrying. You know, shows like X Factor, I have to say, maybe just maybe part of the problem and not the solution here, that when you get young people who are so impressionable at a very, you know, the teenagers who are very impressionable, watching these shows and downloading videos of their music stars who they follow, and they see all this celebrity-driven stuff, the bling and the money. I suppose it's only natural that impressionable young people would find that very attractive and would want to pursue the end goal rather than the purpose of being and doing your work and things that you love.
Particularly because the kind of narrative of some of these contestants, you know, when they have their kind of backstory, it's always, you know, my granddad's just died of cancer and I've only got one leg and I really need to win the X Factor because of whatever. In a sense, that's perpetuating this myth that a quick shortcut to fame is going to solve that person's problems and therefore you, the viewer's problems as well, if you do it as well.
Yes. It's a difficult one, isn't it? I think the X Factor does give genuine opportunity to people who wouldn't otherwise have a voice, you know, and they wouldn't get a look in to a record company, and you know they could publish on YouTube, and some of them do, quite a few of them do get success there. You know, it's mutual exploitation in a way, because the show gets the talent, and they get the exposure, and so it's a win-win. It's kind of a win-win, I think. But what happens at the end of the process worries me slightly. As I said earlier, fame I think destroys more people than it helps, and fame in of itself is not a desirable position to be in, to be famous. You know, I couldn't imagine what it must be like to be really, really famous and to be unable to walk out onto the streets and do normal stuff, you know, without being recognised. I would find that very intrusive personally. I mean, some people can cope with it, and I do know many who do, and they enjoy it. But it's something that, it's a personal decision of mine, I really wouldn't care for that intrusive quality of life.
Do you have a kind of voice training regime, something to keep your voice tip-top? And also, when you very kindly agreed to come on this podcast, I was actually, by pure coincidence, reading Nick Robinson's book. And, of course, he lost his voice, or thought he was going to lose his voice, to cancer. And, you know, do you, if you don't mind asking, is your voice, like, insured or something? Because, you know, I remember the old days where Hollywood starlets would say, oh, my legs are insured for millions of pounds, because it was more of a PR thing. But your voice is your actual business. Maybe it should be insured for £1 million.
Well, it's terrifying, right? I sometimes do think about these things, and I think the only thing that's keeping me from the breadline and my family from absolute abject poverty are two very thin pieces of mucous membrane sitting right inside my throat, which is not a terribly comfortable thought. So you're absolutely right. I do have insurance on my voice, and in case, God forbid, touching wood, I ever lost it for whatever reason, I would be able to, you know, carry on with some level of income.
Non-poverty.
non-poverty is a good thing. So, yes, it's only sensible, I think, when you've got dependents to be careful with making sure that these sort of things are thought about and covered.
How do you take care of it? I mean, do you speak less when you're at home, for example? Like, I know a few people that are involved in kind of a lot of voice work and radio stuff, and they tend to deliberately speak a lot less. I have a friend of mine, Pat, who's a singer, who won't speak after a gig and, you know, will rest his voice deliberately.
Well, I've always been blessed with Teflon-coated vocal cords, and I think the only thing I do, really, people say, oh, do you gargle with scotch or Jack Daniels? Do you smoke cigars? I mean, to be honest with you, all of these things are bad for the human voice. I mean, the only thing that really you should be drinking is H2O. Water is the best thing, and drink lots of it. If you think of it, I went to see
special... Yeah, but you can't beat a few bevvies and a few fags.
No, you can have... I don't smoke, but I do enjoy a drink. But the sad fact is that alcohol does dry your voice out, so it makes it weaker. I do drink lots of water, though. That's the only thing that's really good for you. A specialist I went to see said that what you should look at water as like the oil for your engine, for your vocal engine. So drinking, you know, 2 litres of that stuff a day keeps the engine oiled and keeps your vocal cords in good health. And, you know, if it's the only tool of your trade, as it is mine, then, you know, I have to look after it. So, you know, try and get 8 hours sleep a night. That's what I try to do. I try to drink plenty of water. I don't necessarily rest my voice too much because I do use it every day and sometimes quite aggressively in computer games, whatever I'm doing, big shows, advertising. So I do speak an awful lot. But so drinking plenty of water and just getting plenty of rest at night is the only two things you can really do.
Do you get hoarse? I mean, sometimes when I'm giving presentations and I'm speaking for an hour, I genuinely do get a sore-ish throat.
Mm.
Do you get that?
No, I never get a sore throat. You sometimes get what's called cotton mouth. You know, when you're speaking, particularly in an air-conditioned room, if you're speaking continuously for a period of time, you can dry, your voice can dry out. And, of course, not just your mouth dries, but your vocal cord dry out too.
You sound like you've got a dry voice at that point.
That's why you should be sipping water as you speak, you know. So don't be, you know, if you're public speaking, I always insist on a glass of water on the lectern or nearby that I'm going to do it now.
Well, while you're drinking, I always thought that the three golden rules of public speaking were stand up, speak up, and then shut up.
Yes, as quickly as possible. Nobody wants to hear you droning on. Yeah, so I think, yes, looking after your voice is pretty critical. And I do warm-up exercises before I do work. So if I'm going to be going into a session that requires me to be shouting a lot or being energetic, I will do a warm-up. So it's usually... The best warm-ups are vocal sweeping up and down with my up through the and down through the register, and just continuous tongue twisters. You know, you just come up with things that get the muscles of articulation in your jaw, lips, and tongue used to moving in extreme directions, so that when you come to read, it's your muscle memory is such that, you know, it's not such an effort, and so you're less likely to stumble over your words. The other thing I do is I've trained myself to do, and I train other people to do this, is to read ahead on when you're reading copies. The reason people stumble are two reasons. One is their muscles of articulation aren't warmed up properly, and secondly, they're not reading ahead. The eye is not scanning the line ahead of the one they're actually reading. I teach people to speed read and to scan lines so you know what's coming up. Punctuation is important, of course. It's like musical notation. So very often I'll get scripts that are so badly punctuated that I have to actually stop the recording session and put my own punctuation notes into the script so I know where there are falling inflections, rising inflections, full stops, new paragraphs.
Do you ever go beyond that, though, and think, actually, forget the punctuation, this copy's a bit crap? That might suggest a few rewrites.
Yes.
Or do you deliberately kind of stop yourself doing that? Because it's not your job to be a script doctor.
No, it's... Sometimes it is. I mean, it depends on the client. I mean, if you're working with somebody who trusts you and you offer an honest and explicit opinion about a script and how it could be improved, then very often people will welcome that suggestion and happily agree to the amendment. Some people maybe not so. You know, they're more wedded to their copy. They've probably spent a long time writing it, and it's been approved through various stages, through agencies and other bodies who approve scripts. And so by the time I get to it, it's kind of more or less fixed in stone. It all depends on the job. But where I can, I will always consider it part of my job to suggest how these things might be improved, whether they agree and adopt the improvement and the suggested changes is up to them. But part of my job to help where I can.
Help mitigate the problems with clients' brief, should we say. So final two questions, Peter, actually. One is, I wonder whether you could kind of indulge us and talk through some of the career highlights, share some anecdotes, and maybe drop a few names here and there. And then I think the final thing I'd like to ask you is what's next for you? I mean, clearly you've developed an incredible niche. You're already at the top of your game. Are you just going to carry on, or is there something that you'd like to do differently? So there's two questions for you.
More than two. I think there might have been four there. career highlights. I suppose, let me think. Initially, working for Radio 2 was a great career highlight for me. It was wonderful. I worked on Radio 1 as well with Steve Wright. That was a great learning experience. Then I think X Factor, of course, was a huge thing in my life. And everything that's flowed from that, Britain's Got Talent, All Star, Family Fortunes, Mr. and Mrs., Live at the Apollo, all those big light entertainment, shiny floor shows that I do. And another great highlight, I have to say, was, and came quite out of the blue, was the London 2012 Olympic Games, where I was invited to be, I didn't know how I was going to tell my wife this, but they asked me to be the voice of the beach volleyball event in Horse Guards Parade, which was just an amazing thing to be asked to do. And what an experience that was, turning up every day at this huge sand pit in Horse Guards Parade, surrounded by, 70,000-seater stadium,
just,
which
just
was just
opposite St James's Park, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know it.
And stand literally 15 feet from the touchline on the volleyball court and commentate and gee up the crowd with all kinds of ridiculous nonsense. It was almost like we were having fun, too much fun, in fact, and there was a party going on and just happened to be an Olympic event on at the same time.
But you were there to provide fun, weren't you? Not to kind of give any in-depth analysis as to the volleyball technique.
Well, I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought that I was going to be commentating on the volleyball. And so I was sitting at home, in the months before the Olympic Games started, thinking any day now there's going to be this huge ring binder pack of information will come thudding through my letterbox.
The rules
with
of volleyball.
With the brief and the rules of volleyball. And as the weeks and days went by and the countdown to the Olympics began, and literally a week before, I was beginning to panic, and I thought, I have no idea what I'm doing. I better go and look on YouTube to see how this game is played. So literally in the week or two before the event began, I was looking at clips of the game and reading the International Federation Handbook for Volleyball and boning up on it. And when I got there, I was kind of relieved to see that I wasn't the stadium game announcer. I was the presentation announcer for the event, which was slightly different and much more fun because we were just, as you say, warming the crowd up, keeping them up and regaling them with all kinds of nonsense that I made up on the spur of the moment about spurious and nonsensical historical facts about London, because it was largely a lot of visitors from different countries were there. And I remember one evening, a lot of the crowd had settled down and been to the bar several times, and it was a very merry atmosphere. I remember saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, in between games this was, may I have your attention, please? I've had a note from number 10 Downing Street. Number 10 Downing Street, as you know, is just over there," and it literally was on the other side of the wall. "Prime Minister, as you know, the Prime Minister of this country, Mr. David Cameron, has got a very important meeting tomorrow with the Japanese Prime Minister, and he's asked us all, he'd like to get an early night, and he's asked us all if we could possibly please keep the noise down." Well, you can imagine, the place went up like
everyone
a tinderbox.
Crazy.
Everybody went crazy, and it was noted by the Prime Minister, and who dropped a note to Seb Coe the next day asking me, "Could I please not do it again?" Which, of course, I did.
What's next for you then?
We're going for total global domination now. We've conquered most of the English-speaking countries. And,
I think you have, actually. I mean, you are the most well-known voice, I would say, and beloved as well. And I'm not just saying that to flatter you, but there's a huge outpouring of warmth toward you, do you not think?
I didn't realise this. It's very sweet of you to say all that. When I got to the end of my 12th year on The X Factor, I thought... And Dermot O'Leary had decided to leave, and there was lots of changes on that show. I decided maybe it's a good time for me to hang my hat up here as well. So I announced my retirement in a very quiet way on Twitter. It was just like one line. Well, I was absolutely overwhelmed by, within 3 minutes, Radio 5 Live were on the phone asking for an interview. 57 publications picked it up. There was articles here, then, everywhere, online, in print.
It went crazy.
It went absolutely ballistic. I was under siege for days. And it made me realise, actually, you know, maybe this was the wrong decision. Maybe I should just stay on and see this through. And because, as you mentioned earlier, you know, once you've done something that long, you become...
You're a key ingredient of the show.
The sonic signature of the show, or whatever show you're doing, if you've done it that long. I had this call from the production the week before the live shows last year. I think they were under a lot of pressure because there had been so many changes, change of presenters, change of format, and so many things had changed that I think they thought, or they considered that it was one change too many to have me not there. And they asked me if I would come back and reconsider. And I'm glad I said yes, and I'm glad I did, because, you know, looking back on it, if I'd not gone back, I would have had to have listened to somebody else doing that.
Which would have been...
It would have sounded odd to me. Yeah. I'd imagine it'd be rather like somebody running off with your wife, you know.
It sounded odd to the audience, though, as well.
It was nice to find that out and to be back in that seat again and to have that lots of positive things said, which was great.
So what is next then? Is it more of the same?
The same. I mean, as I said, no 2 days are the same for me anyway, so I've got tons of variety in my work, which is great, keeps me interested. I've also started in the last 2 years a company called Gravy for the Brain, gravyforthebrain.co.uk, .com, I should say. And I've got an interest in that company, and it's a training company. So we train people in all aspects of using their voice, be it singing. We run online courses which people can take, and they are courses that are conducted by experts in their field. So we've got mastering public speaking, we've got singing, we've got creating demos for voiceover artists, advanced voiceover courses, beginners voiceover courses, acting for computer games, loads of different things. And there's lots of free resources on there as well that people can dig into and find out. So on a business side, that's my next kind of big business venture. And we are now, in the past 2 years, we've become the largest trainer of voices in the world now.
Wow.
We've trained something like 30,000 individuals online.
And just to check the website address, what was it?
It's www.gravyforthebrain.com.
Excellent. Peter, thank you ever so much for a genuinely enjoyable and very informative interview. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for asking me.
A Big Things Media production. Big Things!